was consumed by evil.
For as long as you can remember, you've struggled against your own black heart.
Shoot through him.
Every man pays a price for redemption.
I'm not looking for redemption.
You have no choice. But I'll teach you to use your black shadow to fight evil.
He became the shadow.
I didn't see anything, I swear.
Dump him.
Who's there?
Did you think you'd get away with it? Did you think I wouldn't know?
Now, when the world is in danger.
Report.
Police investigation of murder. Agent advises inquiry.
Who knows what powers stir in the night?
Whatever you did, it's in the past.
Join me. Inside you beats a heart of darkness.
I do what I do to fight back the evil inside me, but some part of it is still there, waiting.
Genghis Khan conquered half of the world in his lifetime. I intend to finish the job.
And when the adventure begins,
activate the bomb.
Who knows where it will end? Alec Baldwin, John Lone, Penelope Ann Miller, and Tim Curry. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and join me for this special Sunday edition of the Film and Water Podcast, our fellow network all-stars, Siskoid. Hi, Siskoid.
Hi.
And Max Romero.
The sun is shining.
I love it. So we're doing this special Sunday edition of the Film and Water Podcast to celebrate the anniversary of The Shadow. Of course, Chris and Ryan over on Nightcast celebrated the debut of the character with a special episode featuring some help from our pal Zoom Yukinori. And I just thought it would be fun to talk about The Shadow movie starring Alec Baldwin and Penelope Ann Miller. To this point, we haven't covered it on the Film and Water Podcast. Chris and Cindy did it over on Supermates many, many years ago, but I haven't had a chance to talk about it. And I thought it would be fun, since this is The Shadow's anniversary month and year, to talk about this interesting, maybe not completely successful movie. We'll get into it. But before we get further on into the film itself, I have to ask you guys, Siskoid, I'll start with you. What, if anything, kind of history do you have with this character?
I'm not sure what my first contact was. I think it was a confluence of, like Chris actually said on that show, Jeff Rovin's Encyclopedia of Superheroes, the O'Neill, Sienkiewicz, and later Kyle Baker series that used The Shadow in the modern era, and the Dark Horse comics from just around the time of this movie, just before. The Shadow in the Coils of Leviathan by Kaluta, Goss, and Gianni had come out in 93, I think. So I was buying those comics. I was reading those comics. And later, much closer to this time period, I was a fan of Dynamite bringing back the pulp heroes, though I think my soft spot was really The Spider by then. And aside from Doc Savage, The Spider is really the only one of these pulp characters that I own and have read some of their original pulp stories. So that's not the case with The Shadow. He's always been there. There are a lot of pulp references, pop references to the character in media. And so I feel like everybody knows the catchphrases, even mm-hmm. if they don't have much of a background with them.
When the movie came out, did you?
Oh, I was there. Yeah, I saw it. Okay. I saw it in theaters. Yeah, for sure. I didn't remember much from it, I have to admit. I don't know. I don't know why. I can't keep 1,500 movies or 2,000 movies or whatever in my head at all times, and having only seen it once, it was fun to revisit. I actually liked it. I liked it better probably now than I did then.
I'm going to say the same thing. I watched it just the other night, and it was better than I remember it. But Max, what about you? What's your history with this character?
excuse me. Like a lot of things, it goes back to my parents. My dad, my parents were old enough, and you guys might be able to to back me up on this. But my parents were old enough that they were right at that edge of radio and TV. You know, like TV was still a new thing.
And, oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, and so they, my parents grew up, my dad especially, grew up listening to stuff on the radio. And The Shadow, I guess, probably rebroadcasts were part of that. So when I was growing up, I was already into Batman and everything else. And, you know, my dad was one of those guys who said, well, you know who came first. and he started telling me about The Shadow. And I kind of picked up some of the paperbacks and things like that. And then nothing, you know, I mean, but that wasn't really what hooked me. What really got me, I think, was the Helfer and Sienkiewicz run at DC on The Shadow. And I think that's what really, really kind of got me to it. And I backed up from there and started, you know, finding the magazines and the paperbacks and that sort of thing. And I've just, you know, I've been a fan ever since.
Did you see the movie when it came out?
I did. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 94. And I was already dating my now wife and we went together. Yeah. So we both, this is a movie that we saw together. And, you know, like Siskoid said, I remember liking it at the time and I still had a lot of fun watching it this time. I mean, it obviously is not a great movie. I mean, but it's not bad. It's not bad. What's weird is that for me, I kind of smashes together with Dick Tracy and
sure, yeah.
Yeah, and oh, what's that other movie? Anyway, I put these movies together. Oh, The Phantom.
I would have loved it if the movie you were looking for was Batman 89.
Pointy ears, he has a cave. I always kind of smash those together, even though they were years apart. And, but they just kind of have the same, I really like Dick Tracy. I'm not that big a fan of The Phantom. I know. I'm sorry. It's Siskoid.
I like all three of these films. So
yeah. And you know, and so it was nice to revisit.
Yeah. It was the 90s for those of you too young to remember, the 90s was kind of a real bumper crop of, kind of strange comic book movies because after Batman, every company was like searching through their, you know, their coffers, like, who do we have? And Disney was Dick Tracy. And then there was The Phantom. There was The Rocketeer, The Shadow. I mean, everybody was trying to do something, get their own version off the ground. And as we'll talk about the movie itself, I think the weakest parts of this movie is where they are trying to jam it into that Batman mold.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the stuff that's – but again, we'll talk about that in a moment. My personal history with the character, part of it is I was a fan of Orson Welles. I have been for a really long time. And The Shadow is one of those few radio shows that seem to have an ongoing life outside of the format of radio going away, essentially. I would argue probably 99% of the radio shows that ever existed – have not been bothered to be transferred to vinyl or cassette or CD. They're just forgotten. Nowadays old time radio is a bigger thing, but in the 80s, you really didn't find much other than Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, which Max, you and I even covered on Film and Water a couple of years ago. And then Orson Welles' episodes of The Shadow. And part of it is it got glommed on because of Orson Welles, even though he only played the character briefly. It was like, oh, Orson Welles is The Shadow. And so, oh, here's a bunch of vinyl records of his adventure. So I ended up getting some of those radio programs. And I'll admit, I'm not the hugest fan of them. They're more fun in concept than they are in reality. But I still did enjoy them. And, of course, I do remember the comics. I enjoyed the Howard Chaykin series, even if it's, you know, I think probably to a lot of Shadow purists, it's not exactly what they're looking for. But I enjoyed that. And, yeah, he was a character that was always around. Ryan and Chris talked about his appearance in Batman in the 70s. And I remember I had that first issue where he appeared and I always thought he had a cool look. And so when this movie came out, I was all on board. I thought it looked really cool. I was like, all right, it looks really nice. The concept is cool. The power set is cool. So I was on board for all of it. The movie itself is, let's talk about the credits a little bit. It's directed by Russell Mulcahy. This is basically his last big theatrical release movie. He was mostly a music video director, and he would go back and forth between doing music videos and movies. He, of course, directed – he's most famous for Highlander 2, The Quickening. He did The Real McCoy with Kim Basinger, and this was like his big shot. And one of the things I was shocked to learn when I was researching this movie was that it was not really very successful at all. I seem to recall that it was like a moderate success, but I was reading on Wikipedia that it made less than $50 million in the U.S., which is shocking to me. I mean, Batman made like $300 million. So this thing was not, there was no chance there was ever going to be a second film because this thing just went kind of nowhere, unfortunately. It's, of course, stars Alec Baldwin as Lamont Cranston, The Shadow, Penelope Ann Miller, John Lone as Siwan Khan, and then a really great cast of supporting actors, Peter Boyle, Ian McKellen, Tim Curry chewing the scenery, Jonathan Winters, the great Jonathan Winters, Shab Shimono, Andre Gregory from My Dinner with Andre, James Hong, John Capelos is the janitor from The Breakfast Club, is the first goon that the Shadow basically takes care of. And it was written by David Koepp, the Jurassic Park Indiana Jones screenwriter, David Koepp. The plot, basically, as it is, it's in the 1930s New York City, the Shadow, Alec Baldwin, battles his nemesis, Siwan Khan, played by John Lone, who was building an atomic bomb. So we all watched this movie recently. Hmm. We kind of liked it more the second time around or the third time around or the fourth time around recently than we did the last time. So, I mean, overall, like, so I'll start with you, Cisco. What did you like about – we can talk about what we didn't like in a minute, but what did you like about The Shadow?
Yeah, I do want to address your roster of stars in there because there's also a couple of the dad from Alf, isn't it?
And, that's right, yeah.
And from Misfits of Science, Ethan Phillips, who's Neelix in Star Trek.
Oh, I knew I should have mentioned that. I knew you would.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Didn't Mulcahy also direct like the first Highlander? It's not just the second one, right? He did the first one.
Okay. I was doing it to trigger some angry comments.
Okay, well, I know exactly who you're triggering. Although his best film ever is Razorback. It's an Australian. No, it's like his first probably, but it's an Australian horror film or monster creature film, I guess. It looks amazing. It should be seen. Anyway, so as to The Shadow, I think expectations are different. At the time, you're very close to Batman 89. It is doing Batman 89. There's a lot of, it's like Jerry Goldsmith is aping Elfman and the score. I mean, it feels like they're just trying to jam that into it. There's a Vicky Vale moment for Margot. There's who are you? On the bridge, it's like a precarious fall for a goon. It's like the general mood is very much Batman 89. So at the time, it really felt like it felt like a pale copy of a film that that I'd seen 100 times, basically. Batman 89 being the one VHS tape I had.
And
I watched it a lot. So so beyond that, I think now we were far from that, and I can enjoy it for the things that it does well or that it does differently from Batman. I mean, this is pure 1930s pulp in most ways. There's this orientalism that's a bit off-putting now in a way, but and even back in 94 for that matter. But so this is Batman with mysticism. And what strikes me most, I'll tell you what really struck me this last time, is how much of the Shadow's DNA is in other characters that we know. So Batman is obvious, of course, but now to mainstream audiences, they might look at this and go, oh, this is sort of where Doctor Strange came from. It's where the Creeper comes from. The Punisher, Margot Lane, Lois Lane. Lois premiered a year after Margot did on the radio. So a lot of this I knew, of course, in the abstract, but having it on screen kind of crystallizes it. And you can tell, okay, well, this character, this very early character, is in the DNA of so many others. And the movie shows you that.
Max, what did you feel about when you watched it the second time around?
Well, I think Cisco kind of hits it right on the head, because that distance lets you get away from Batman. And it's it's good because it kind of reminds me of when John Carter came out a few years ago, or I don't know, 10 years ago, I don't remember how long it was. But when John Carter came out and everyone was complaining, oh, this is just trying to bite on Star Wars. And it's like, no, Star Wars was biting on John Carter. And, you know, with Batman 89 being still so fresh in so many people's minds, and it's easy to say, well, you know, this is just a ripoff of Batman. And in a lot of ways it was. You know, a lot of the framing was very similar. The score is almost ridiculously close to the Batman theme. But I would argue that it is more, it has more of a pulp sensibility than a comic book sensibility. And I think that kind of plays true to the character and that background. And I appreciate that, you know, because if you know anything about The Shadow, the movie is actually fairly true to the character. And I also appreciate that. Siskoid also mentioned the Orientalism.
Yes. And the stress is on the ta.
Golly.
Orientalism.
Orientalism. Hey, there we go. And so, but one thing I appreciated was that it kind of played with that, with those tropes a little bit. For example, when Alec Baldwin is introduced as Lamont Cranston in the beginning, he's in shadow, and you see the traditional Asian clothing and the long nails, and it's very reminiscent of the Yellow Peril stereotype. But then you know, he leans forward and it's Alec Baldwin. And so I kind of appreciated that they turned that on its head. No one is speaking in a stereotypical way. Everyone is kind of just, you know, everyone has a command of English without, you know, overdone accents or mispronunciations or anything like that. And so that's a small thing, but I appreciate that they obviously made some sort of effort to be true to the Shadow's greatest nemesis without bringing along so much of that stereotypical baggage. And that carries through the whole movie.
Yeah, I had no idea that Shawan Khan was from the stories. I thought he was made up for the movie. But he actually does come from the original pulp stories, which I thought, that's kind of cool. I had no idea. We mentioned the music. The costume designers, to say, Bob Ringwood is the same guy that did Batman that did this. So I said, obviously, Universal was like, let's just clone this as best we can. The opening sequence in China after that. I'm talking about the sequence on the bridge, which I love that. When I watched it, I remember seeing this movie in the theater. I loved it the first time, and I loved it. I've loved it every time I've watched it, every time I watched this movie. I just thought it was really fun. And the whole, and I don't know whether it was done with computer effects. This feels like it was, I mean, Jurassic Park was a year before this, so it's not pre-CGI, but it's early CGI. Mm-hmm. But that whole scene of where he is a mist and he's popping out of the mist and punching people is, to me, so cool and so well done that I get frustrated that it's the only scene like that in the whole movie that we get. That's something that the Marvel movies and pretty much later superhero movies would not repeat. Where, you know, in the 90s, they were really stingy with superheroes doing stuff. You kind of got like one scene of them. And I wish to God that they had done more of that. Instead, they get right to sort of the stuff with Shawan Khan, and they get into the whole thing with the atomic bomb and Ian McKellen being Penelope Ann Miller's father and all this stuff. And I like all that stuff, but man, that sequence on the bridge is so fun and so shadowy. Like the thing that I want out of The Shadow that I just get so frustrated that we never see it again. I really thought that whole sequence of that was great. Something that I will mention that was, I found frustrating. I know we were kind of jumping around a little bit because I wanted to get to the positive stuff first, but I had forgotten rewatching it why this movie does the whole bit where his face changes. Mm-hmm. When he's got the cowl on, and they never explain that. And I always found that to be a very weird detail, that his face contorts into this different face that's not the Alec Baldwin face, and they never I think Alan Baldwin would have looked just fine with the red kerchief over his face. I know that they wanted to stay probably closer to the classic profile of what he looks like in the drawing, but I don't know. Am I the only one who found that just very awkward that his face changes and they don't really get into why?
Well, for me, it wasn't, and this might just be because I already knew things about The Shadow, and you shouldn't expect that of a moviegoer. I mean, people should be able to go in and see and watch a movie without having to, study beforehand.
Right.
But I took it, when I watched the movie, I took it to be he was basically hypnotizing people to see him that way. And also, there's, I'm kind of thinking that he is disguising himself to basically throw people off the track, because when he first goes to see Dr. Tam, he says, "Oh, you're an agent of the Shadow." You know, he never realizes that he is the Shadow. He is actually the Shadow. He thinks he's just another agent.
And in the stories, it's kind of like that. In some of the stories, I think on radio, Lamont Cranston is the Shadow. In the pulp stories, the original pulp stories, Lamont Cranston is not the Shadow. He's an agent of the Shadow, but kind of the protagonist, because we can't be with the Shadow all the time. There's a confusion there sometimes in some of the stories. So they've sort of name-checked that here. You know, that's the reference to that in a way. That's not my take on it. My take on it, and this is without having read the pulps, because maybe there's an explanation there, because I think in the pulps maybe he changes his face. It's possible. But to me, it's psychological. What the Lama that he meets in northern Tibet allows him to do is to harness his darkness, because after the war, he has become this sort of warlord in the desert, and he's thoroughly evil and ruthless, basically. So
the when he finds Lhasa,
yeah. So when he finds this guru, this mentor, he is taught these tricks. But the way that it's presented is that you have a darkness inside you, a shadow. And they allow him to harness that shadow, and then he lets it out. And when he lets it, it's a Jekyll and Hyde thing. Okay. So when he lets it out, he physically changes to be that ruthless, evil, maniacal creature, but it's under control. If I let it loose on evildoers, then it's cathartic, and it takes care of that, and I can live my life as a good person, as Lamont Cranston. And so he's sort of manipulating the Shadow into doing so-called good works, but very violently. So I think that's what's happening. So when he transforms into the Shadow, he's actually letting loose that dark side.
Okay. I never really considered that, but now that when I watch – the next time I watch the movie, maybe it won't bother me as much, because I'm always like – every time we see him, and I'm like, he's got this putty on his face. I'm like, what is he doing here? But did you
think that Baldwin was good in the roles? Because I felt like when he's the barbarian, when he's the, in China, not so good. Mm-hmm. When he's Lamont Cranston, he's okay. When he's the Shadow, the laugh and the posture, and that's when I liked him. Like, I thought he had the Shadow down, but the other elements of his personality, eh.
Yeah, I don't get a sense of a whole lot of like deep darkness in him. I just think I think Alec Baldwin's a good actor. I think he's better at sort of light comedy, and the scenes in this movie that are funny are pretty funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does feel like this is what Jack Donaghy was doing when he was younger.
I can't see him now and not think of Jack Donaghy.
Well,
it's weird, because for me, in the scenes with when he's just supposed to be Lamont and Cranston, they flip flop between Jack Donaghy and his character from Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yes.
And
Balls of Steel.
Yeah, Balls of Steel. But it totally works. I mean, I find him charming as Lamont. I think he was a good choice. But yeah, his Shadow is just, I think, kind of just inspired. It's really what I always pictured in my mind when I've read about the Shadow.
Yeah, because when he's Lamont Cranston, when he suddenly does like do the eye trick, when he clouds men's minds, and then they do like that, he sits back and the lighting changes, and there's just like bright light on his eyes, and all of like when he's tapping into the Shadow powers, like that's cool. That's really cool. But otherwise, it's not as interesting, I think, as Tim Burton's Batman, or like the Bruce Wayne. The Michael Keaton Bruce Wayne has like a complexity and an oddness He doesn't do that with Lamont Cranston here. So it's a very different, like, yes, it feels like Batman. It's kind of, he kind of wanted it to be Batman, but it's really not. I feel like, especially now I can tell, it's like, no, I don't feel like I'm watching the same kind of film at all.
Right. Yeah. And I agree with you, Rob. When he's Zinko, the warlord, the only thing I could think, I could keep thinking was, my God, that wig is awful.
Yeah. It just, and the other part of that sequence that it did not age well for me was the perba. I just, the little knife with its little mouth, and it reminded me of like the Zuni doll from Trilogy of Terror. Like, it just, I know that, like, to me, I'm like, it just looks so silly where it's trying to grab this thing and it's trying to bite him. I don't know.
It's a mean little knife.
It seems a little silly.
It seems out of a lot of 80s movies. You know, there's a lot of weird mystical hybrids.
Trouble in Little China. Yeah, I can see it in that.
Is right. The best one, but, you know, the Golden Child. And there, right.
The Golden Child.
There's a number of very odd 80s films where like that, that are kind of bonkers just because they're hybrids. It kind of feels like it would fit in one of those films.
What do you guys think of the chemistry between him and Penelope Ann Miller? You think it works, or is it pro forma that he's simply got to have? I mean, obviously Margot Lane is a character from the story, so they're not making this up. But at the same time, they were always going to have a romantic interest in these movies. You can never just have a straight superhero adventure. He's always got to have a love interest.
I mean, this is a person with an impressive CV. I mean, the actress, you know, she was in Awakenings, Carlito's Way, The Artist, more recently Chaplin. My personal favorite of hers is Adventures in Babysitting. Kindergarten Cop, if you like, but she's comparatively weak compared to, like, all these big actors in the film otherwise, you know. So she's just like flavor of the day kind of character. The fact that she has like these psychic powers and he can't cloud her mind, she can sort of read his and other people's, I think it's interesting. I think it creates a relationship that's interesting. There's not no chemistry, but it's not like a major feature for me.
Mm. Max, what did you think?
I felt that there was really just very little chemistry between Baldwin and Penelope Ann Miller. And it might just also be, I enjoy Penelope Ann Miller as an actor, but she's also one of those actors who always kind of plays the same way. In whatever movie she's in, the situation changes, but her characterization doesn't necessarily change. I appreciate that you can see that she's trying. I mean, she is trying really hard to be kind of a femme fatale, ingenue type, you know, befitting the period. But, you know, she can certainly fill out a satin slip, yeah, it doesn't. She doesn't really bring a whole lot, and I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of another actor who might have filled that role better. But what she brings to it, I guess, really any other actor could have done. I do, like I said, I mean, I don't hate her, and she's certainly not a sore spot in the movie for me. But she doesn't take away, but she doesn't necessarily add a whole lot. And that was a kind of a neat little spin about her having, you know, telepathic powers herself and not being able to fall under the spell of the shadow, even though she somehow falls under the spell of Shiwan Khan early on.
I think it shows that Shiwan Khan is more powerful, more dangerous.
I guess. I was wondering if that was. Yeah, I don't know if that was what they were supposed to do, or but that kind of threw me off. But rather than Margot having telepathy, I would have preferred that she was just smart. You know, I would have liked if she had just figured it out instead of just going, oh, well, you know, I get static in my head when you're around, so you must be the shadow. But, you know, again, it didn't. It was a small thing. It was nothing that took me out of the movie.
So, all right, we mentioned Shiwan Khan, played by John Lone. And one of the things I felt that this movie tried a little too hard to make it Batman is that they, and again, I haven't read the stories. Maybe they took these from the stories, but I didn't think, is that, it's that their origin is tied together. Comic book movies love to do that. They even when it's Batman, they have to tie the origin in together. I think movie studios think you can't just have a villain. It's got to have that they spring from the same source. And that stuff always frustrates me. It's like, why can't the shadow just face a bad guy? Why does Siobhan Khan also have to be a disciple from this, of the same guy that taught The Shadow. It's not as bad here as it is in Batman. To me, Batman, it's almost unforgivably crowbarred in, that the Jack Napier is the one that kills Bruce Wayne's parents. And if you've ever read the unproduced, Batman Returns script, which originally featured Robin, you find out that the Penguin is also involved in Bruce Wayne's parents' murder.
Oh, my God.
you're just like, anybody that wasn't involved in this murder? I mean, come on. I don't know. Did that bother either one of you guys that it's another one of these, all right, the villain and the hero have to essentially spring from the same cloth?
It seemed very easy to me. But I guess in its predictability, it was kind of almost expected. I wish they had tried a little harder, because it was very kung fu movie, oh, you killed my master sort of stuff, which is, you know, that's well trod territory. But again, I don't know why, but I'm very forgiving of this movie. I noticed that, but you know, again, it's a lot of that happens a lot in this movie. Things are kind of introduced and then never really followed up on, which can make you wonder why it was done that way in the first place, except, you know, they needed some sort of, you know.
They thought they had a series.
Yeah, yeah, you know, they had to do something with it.
Yeah, because I wish we'd seen the Batcave a little more, you know, with the video phone and all. there was a lot of world building, or there was world building, and then you had questions about that piece of the world.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And you can tell that they were building this as with sequels in mind. And, you know, I'm just going to get it out right now. I wish there had been a sequel. I would have liked to have seen where else they went with this, but you know, that, you know, it just audience they didn't latch onto it. So it never happened.
Yeah. Cause I think Siobhan Khan is, like his origin story in the books was very much like tied to Lhasa, that, you know, that area in China. It's the Shadow that that's what they invented here, I think.
Right.
That the Shadow also had those origins, because I think they play it coy and really in the stories where you don't really know, like it's all a mystery or something. But I remember, like, I knew Siobhan Khan from the comics, because that series, that Bill Sienkiewicz drawn series, that whole first arc was exactly this movie, except it took place in the 80s. Like they all survived at that time. All the pulp stories had happened, and now Siobhan Khan was making a comeback, and the Shadow had to come back for that. You know, still alive, and everybody was still alive. Or you know, maybe it's like Margot Lane's granddaughter or something. I don't remember, but Siobhan Khan was definitely the villain in that. So I already knew. Okay, this is the archenemy. This is the Joker. This is the Lex Luthor of the piece. No, I didn't really mind that they were connected, because it gives a reason for Siobhan Khan to come to New York. You know, if he's this like villain in Mongolia and northern China, why does he need to come to New York at all? He comes because he's got a kindred spirit there, or so he thinks. You know, he killed the mentor. He's Baron Mordo. to take that Doctor Strange. He's Baron Mordo. He killed the Ancient One, and now he's coming after Doctor Strange. So that's kind of the thing that's going on. At some point, Chow Yun-Fat was possibly going to play this role.
Wow.
That would have upped its cred with, you know, all the Hong Kong cinema fans like me. But certainly. Yeah. But no, to me, I mean, he is very powerful. And that's why he can grab Margot, and he's got, you know, all these plans. I think the plot itself that he comes up with, or that he gets tangled with once he is in New York, is basically the thing that you keep seeing in like this kind of retro stuff, where like we know what happens later in history. So in pulp stories or in Victorian stories, they'll often do like a plot where, oh, these evil people are creating this machine, and we know that machine was eventually created. Like here, it's the atomic bomb. I mean, curse my eyes. I also saw League of Extraordinary Gentlemen recently, and in that, it's like like, you know, the villains are creating these tanks, and obviously it's a prelude to the First World War. And in this, it's a prelude to the Second World War, which obviously the original stories could not have known about, did not tell these kinds of stories, but we do, you know. I mean, Rocketeer, Indiana Jones, they all do that. You know, you've got plenty of Nazis because the Second World War is coming. But we only know that now, right? It can't be part of the original stories.
I like.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say, if you want to talk about chemistry, I loved every scene with John Lone and Alec Baldwin.
I thought they were great together. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, the arch enemy, the arch villain. The arch enemy chemistry. Yeah, that was on point, and that's really what the story is about. These two brothers, or you know, like. That is very Asian and Chinese. They're brothers because they had the same mentor, but one killed the mentor, and the other one respected and still carries the true lessons. So because Chuan Khan did not somehow harness his dark side, he is his dark side. There is no light side to Chuan Khan. So it becomes this war between light and dark, but fought by two dark warriors.
Yeah, I really thought – I was going to say that I thought the stuff where John Lone is by himself and he's just being Chuan Khan, I thought he was just kind of one note, and that's part of the screenplay's fault. But I really like it when he is with Alec Baldwin. I mean, the whole thing about nice tie, I love that whole bit. I mean, that's really funny. And I mean, I just think they have a real charm there together, and then they let Alec Baldwin as Lamont, as the Shadow. I love that whole – the other – bit later on where he's like, you know, I'm gonna stop you. Like, I liked all that, like, you know, it's like kind of respectful to me. And I mean I like Chuan Khan's, the way he uses some of his powers. I love when he talks that cabbie into blowing himself up. Like, I thought that was fun. This is kind of a nasty evil thing, but most of the time he's just kind of stalking around. And I've seen John Lone in other movies, and I like him a lot. Actually, I've seen him on IMDb. He has not been in anything since 2007. Which is curious to me. I wonder what he's been doing all this time. I liked him a lot, but yeah, I just feel like he just is, he's stiff a lot. And again, that's the screenplay's fault. And I wish they had given him a little more unique kind of stuff to do with Alec Baldwin, or at least just been less of a kind of stock villain overall. I mean, now that I'm sort of saying it, I realize, geez, all these comic book origins tie all their villains together. I mean, the Red Skull and the Captain America are tied together. You know, it's just the Abomination and the Hulk come from the Gamma Ray. You know, that is a trope, and that's not the fault of David Kep. That's just kind of a thing that you do here. We all mentioned the Shadow's agents. I agree. They clearly were planning on, obviously, future films, so they didn't want to explain everything. I like that some of the agents, we don't learn who these guys are. Like the one scene where when Jonathan Winters is essentially the Commissioner Gordon in this movie, and he's talking to like a beat cop, and we see he's got one of the Shadow's rings on. I like that we don't learn who that guy really is. I love that Andre Gregory, the great Andre Gregory, shows up in this movie as just the guy on the radio. He's the guy who's like at the information hub with all the pneumatic tubes.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. I mean, that's somebody that I wish we could have seen more of, but I'm guessing that, you know, they probably booked him for three films, you know, and we just never got to see it.
That's the one thing I remembered from the film that I clearly remembered was the pneumatic tubes thing. It seems so steampunk to me in 94. Now I know this was an actual thing, and I've seen it in other films. It was in Paddington, and to name one recent one. But yeah, that was like the image from the film. I don't know what that says about me, but.
Yeah, and it's a nice Easter egg for fans of The Shadow also, because that's Burbank, who is a pretty well-known character, you know, among the Shadow's agents, but they never name him. Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm not even sure.
Don't they?
I don't think so. And I don't. Does he even have any lines?
He does. There's the one scene where he beeps the Shadow and his ring, and then he goes to that cool radio-looking thing.
Oh yeah,
it looks
like
a big Simon game, and you see him in the center in like the black and white.
Yes, that
I loved all that stuff. That stuff was so cool. I mean, again, if the Shadow had been more successful, they could have like sold that, the little Shadow radio or something. It would have been really cool.
A playset, but you know, And that's one of the things that I think differentiates it from Batman. Batman is Art Deco, but with a really heavy gothic overlay. And the Shadow is just pure Art Deco.
And it's true to it. I mean,
yeah,
it is in that era, whereas Batman is sort of an amalgam of different eras in which the Batman lived. You know, it's set design, but in mm-hmm. the Shadow, it's still set design, but it's
appropriate.
It's appropriate. Yeah. Right.
And it's beautiful. And one of the things I noticed about this movie, and I guess it's, you know, so you can have the long shadows and the noir kind of feel to it, but you know, everything feels like a set. I mean, nothing, you know, you're not going to go like, oh my God, this is so gritty. But every room feels huge and every street feels used. And like you could turn a corner and be on another block. You know, it feels bigger than it. I mean, you feel New York in this movie and you feel that era of, you know, sweeping arcs that whole Art Deco kind of sensibility to it. And, you know, it's just a very pretty movie to look at.
I did love the Shadow Cave. I thought that whole thing was really cool. I mean, just the whole, he flips a switch and like the stairwell collapses in. I mean, I loved all that kind of stuff. I really, again, we'll talk about some of the ancillary merchandise of this movie, because again, Universal was really hoping they had another Batman on their hands. They really should have sold the rings.
Oh my God. Should
have made that a thing. Yeah. Like, I would have bought a Shadow, red, little red ring that lights up or something. I think that would have been really cool. But yeah, the Shadow Cave, I think, is really cool. It is sort of funny that he has to have Peter Boyle pick him up and drive him to his sanctum, which is, you know, that's something Batman would learn in the 70s when he converted Wayne Enterprises in the back. He's like, oh, this is a pain. You know, it's just easier just to live above my secret lair. You know, it's just easier to do it that way. The visuals, I like the matte paintings. I think all the stuff is pretty cool. Yeah, I'm trying not to be too negative about this movie, because when I watched it again, I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it more than I remember enjoying it when I watched it, thinking it was pretty good. And then when I rewatched it, I thought, this is really kind of fun. It doesn't take itself too terribly seriously, which is nice. It moves along at a decent pace. I will say the final sequence with the bomb, with Ian McKellen doing his sort of best John Barrymore kind of, or Lionel Barrymore, sort of a crazy mixed up scientist, and him and Penelope Miller are chasing mm-hmm. the sphere. That part I wish was not in the movie. I feel like the movie's got to start wrapping up, and we have this whole silly sequence of them chasing this thing down the bouncing. I mean, I like the whole snip the wrong wire. Oh, it's the red wire, not the green wire. I like the let's up, but I felt that whole ending was like a little on the silly side. I don't know. Did you guys have a issue with that?
Well, not all the set pieces are of equal value, let's say. You know,
all right, like fair enough.
That bridge scene, yeah, impact, you know, awesome. But, you know, like the bit where Tim Curry is drowning the Shadow, or Lamont Cranston in a sphere, I felt like, where are we? Why are we? Mm-hmm. What is this? You know, and then the Hall of Mirrors is a very good ending. And it would have been longer and more involved, but apparently an earthquake crashed a set. So they lost a week on the shoot because of this, and they had to, you know, shorten it. But otherwise it's a lot of fights inside offices or that kind of stuff. So it's not all, yeah. It's like you said earlier, they put a lot of money on that first scene selling the Shadow, and then well, you coast on that for a while until maybe the end, possibly, you know.
I wish they had done more of him being a shadow. You know, I wish there was more of that, of him throwing his cloak, you know, like, I'm over here, that kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of that in the Nolan Batman movies. I like that whole idea of that he's, you know, you're wasting your ammo shooting. I mean, Tim, there's a little bit in that scene with Tim Curry where he's firing away and he keeps realizing he's, you know, the Shadow is two paces ahead of where he is. I wish they had played up more of that. Because to me, that's part of the coolness of this character, is that he's constantly fooling you. And they hit on it like just bits and pieces here and there. And again, they obviously were planning for future films. Maybe that's something they would have hit up more on. But every time that stuff comes around, I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And then they move off to do something else. And I was like, ah. And all the scenes near the end of him being the Shadow And then they're cutting back to Penelope Ann Miller and Ian McKellen chasing the sphere. I'm like, come on. what are we doing?
The things we don't care about. Right. Yeah, I have a question for Max. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it seemed like there was a reference. You made a reference to it in your opening. And it's the taxi cab, Peter Boyle, you know, like the grandfather of playing the father of the guy he's going to play in Taxi Driver or something. driving the Sunshine Radio taxi cab. And I felt like Sunshine Radio was supposed to be a reference to something. And I was looking up radio stations of the time that might have played The Shadow or whatever. It's not a reference to that, but you put it in a catchphrase. So I'm thinking, was it? What, am I missing something?
You know, I am not sure either. It does sound really familiar. And I want to say that that is actually from The Pulps also, but I am not entirely sure. Part of me thinks that maybe it's they're kind of playing with this idea of, you know, like the whole the sun is – because that's the code phrase. Is the,
yeah,
the,
that's – okay.
The sun is shining, but the ice is slippery.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't know if maybe they're playing around with this idea of yin and yang, you know, of just the two sides of the personalities, like kind of like what you were saying about his face change, or if it's just, you know, an Easter egg. That I'm not sure. But like I said, it does sound familiar. It sounds really familiar, and I'm going to have to look that up because that was kind of bothering me too.
Okay, sorry.
But I do want to say that the shadow effect that you were talking about, Rob, they do use it a few times. They use it when Tim Curry is basically melting down and just shooting a machine gun in a circle.
It does look like a candle that is melting down. He really
Yeah. Oh, my God. No one melts down quite like Tim Curry. And also when there's a fight in the lab and the two warriors actually pin him to the wall with arrows. And there's this cool effect where the shadow kind of steps out of his own shadow
mm-hmm.
and leaves his cloak there, you know, pinned with the arrows. And I thought that was a really cool scene. I would have liked to have seen more also of that sort of thing. But, you know, also that was never a big part of the shadow in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and I worry that if they had done more, if it would have felt that would have felt like they were trying to make a superhero out of a pulp hero.
Yeah, I mean, there are other Shadow movies. We should mm-hmm. point out, and there's a Shadow movie serial as well. And he doesn't have any special powers in those. He's just a guy in a cloak with a neckerchief that runs around him. He doesn't actually have. I mean, he has the power to cloud men's minds, but that's kind of it. He doesn't have any straight up superpowers like he does. Here in this movie. So, yeah, I could see that maybe you don't want to go too far where he's like Doctor Strange, where he has, all these abilities. Yeah. There were lots of little things that I enjoyed. I love the sequences in when Shwan Khan breaks into his secret Santorum and mm-hmm. he reaches down and he has like a little pocket in a wall with a gun in it. And I love that they don't explain that. It's just like the shadow has just tricked out his sanctum. There with all special little doodads. I love that. I love that they don't bother to get in. He's like, oh, he just keeps a gun in a special compartment in case he needs it. I thought that part was really cool. I thought the dream sequence was actually very effective. Russell Mulcahy, I think coming from music videos, obviously is a very visual storyteller. And I thought that that sequence had some real kind of cool visual heft to it. I love the way Penelope Ann Miller looks in that with her like diaphanous gown that she's wearing. Mm-hmm. I thought that was cool. I liked all the stuff where it was sort of unexplained that you had to kind of lean into it a little and sort of figure it out. So I liked all that stuff. And I did like the conclusion. The final scenes of the movie, as you mentioned, Siskoid, that the ending got truncated, the mirror sequence got truncated because of the earthquake and they simply didn't have the money to finish it. So they had to just kind of hobble together in. And the ending doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's just kind of like the shadow just kind of like outshadows Shwan Khan. Mm-hmm. And they're like, all right, the mirrors are shattering. That's it. I loved the final sequence with Shwan Khan in the insane asylum. I thought that had a real kind of like nasty sort of kick to it, that he has been the victim of a of a lobotomy and they took part of his brain out. And the guy that did it was one of the shadow's agents. I thought that had a really kind of nasty feel to it. I thought that was great.
This is a movie where the second time you watch it, you're just looking at hands.
Mm-hmm.
You're just looking at who has a ring that you might not have noticed the first place. This is a very nasty movie, violence-wise. Not often, but it's just wicked. It's a little more wicked than Batman. You know, like when that, you know, that guy on the top of the Empire State Building who is hypnotized to throw himself off. He's got to hit one of the parapets. You know, he's got that's got to hurt. You know, you kind of feel thump. It.
You can hear him hit.
It resonated across the city. So even though this is a historical inaccuracy, he jumps over the, you know, he climbs the fence. That fencing was not put on there until the 40s. Anyways, you know, those moments are really ooh, but it's well shot, and Mulcahy is like. When I was talking up Razorback, which nobody knows, I guess. But
Razorback, I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
It's worth it. Because it is such a visual film. It's like I don't have a lot of money. I'm just doing it with light and shadow, and it looks amazing. It's about a giant pig who kills people in the outback, but it doesn't feel like it's about that. Okay. But even Highlander, like what the things I like about Highlander is the sort of visual maverickness of it. It's like no holds barred. Let's try these things. Let's do things that you don't normally see in films. He's got an eye for that kind of visual. So here, I feel it's a lot more contained because he's sort of maybe he was asked to, you know, emulate Tim Burton or to do a film a certain way. But some moments. And like that sequence with the mirrors, and it's all just played on visuals. Or I really like that overhead shot where you're seeing like the tapestries or their tiles, black and white tiles with tapestry, and the Siobhan Khan's outfit is also made up of those patterns. And
yeah, that's a nice effect. He looks like a butterfly or something.
Yeah, and then he raises up, you know, from a crouching position, and then you realize what you're looking at. But it's all. So visual. So those are like moments like the dream. And so I really like those moments. Maybe most of all, I mean, when a film is kind of like the screenplay is going to be kind of ordinary in ways, if the, you know, cinematographer and director step up and create visual interest, that's going to be an extra half a star.
Yeah, I agree, because I think you can tell, especially on a rewatch, you can tell that they're trying, you know, they're not just phoning it in, and they're not just cranking out a Batman clone, you know, they're trying to bring some a visual thumbprint to this, you know, they're making something of their own. And, you know, obviously there was studio edicts that said Batman, but you know they were still kind of doing their own thing.
I like the idea of a memo that just says that. Batman.
That's all it says. And a lot of the humor in the film is actually, you know, it's like when Alec Baldwin was cast and they met Alec Baldwin and he had this sense of humor to him already. They incorporated a lot of humor into the script that wasn't there before, so. It's still organic. It's not like here's a recipe and you got to follow it. You know, they're filmmakers and they're doing something with it. And there's some of the humor. I felt there's like these little moments, like the two guards at the bomb laboratory who were just like Shane Black characters or something. You know, they're talking about what they want to go eat, and I'm tired of pizza or something. I don't know.
I'm tired of burgers. Yeah,
I'm not eating another hamburger. So it's like. Like these little moments are just add a little more interest to the movie and make it fun to not just watch, but rewatch, I think.
That's what I liked so much about the scenes with Baldwin and Lone, is that they're, it's not just dialogue, you know, they're actually kind of playing off each other. And there's this weird playfulness because, you know, Siobhan Khan, he makes three people kill themselves in the course of this movie. You know, I mean, he has the guy jump off the Empire State Building. He has someone drive into a gas truck, and he has a guard shoot himself in the head.
Poor Neelix.
Right? Yeah. You know, Poor Neelix. This is all pretty grim, right? But at the same time, they get together and there's that, you know, oh, nice tie line that you were talking about, Rob. And they kind of go back and forth on that. And then there's another one where, you know, they're talking about, oh, you know, Siobhan Khan tells him, you know, I remember this raid of this village, and it was what did we say? It was a masterstroke, swift, vicious, and sudden. What genius. And Alec Baldwin just responds with, and that just really, you know, their chemistry together is just really good. And there's the line about, you know, he, Siobhan Khan starts criticizing the decadence of the United States. And Baldwin says, "Hey, pal, that's the US of A you're talking about." You know? And it's like he almost became a different character when he was talking to Siobhan Khan. But it wasn't jarring. Somehow it fits. And I was even wondering, okay, is this another persona he's putting on to put, you know, to kind of keep Siobhan Khan off balance? Or is this Cranston? I was never really sure. But you know, we've talked about this before in when we talk about other movies, but I kind of like not having everything spelled out for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it means you're going to think about the film more. You're going to discuss the film more. It's going to live more with you than if it was just like served on a platter. It's all there. So I agree. It's like I'm a participant when I have to ask questions. And hopefully the questions yield answers that I find interesting. Sometimes it's questions. It's like, well, the answer is it's just badly made. Or, you know, it's not well written. But when the answers are more interesting and when we can have these discussions, like, why does he change his face? And there's actually a couple answers that came out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not all cut and dried. I have one last note, and it's about Taylor Dane's song at the end.
Oh, boy.
Original Sin. Okay, so this song is overproduced, and it could be like three or four different songs, including a Bond theme, the License to Thrill bit. It's like, what is this Bond theme doing in there? But I really like it. So after I watched the movie, I was like, well, I'm finished with the movie, but I want to listen to that song again. And I sort of listened to the song like three or four times or looking at the video, and you see scenes from the movie. So, yeah. Shout out to Original Sin. It really needs like to be lower keyed, though.
Has your mind been clouded by this?
I know. I don't pretend to like it's good. I just like it. I just liked it. You know, because it had like lines from The Shadow in it, sort of about the, you know, what evil lurks inside the hearts of men, and just like these things. I felt, well, it kind of reminds me of the feeling of the film. Where, you know, the producership is maybe like screwing around with things, but what's there is actually enjoyable. So call it a guilty pleasure about this film, but I dig the song.
I really wish there was a Taylor Dane video where they worked in footage of The Shadow into the video like they used to do back then. They would have these kind of really handed sort of things where it's like, can we get on Baldwin for like a day just to shoot some original footage for this Taylor Dane video?
Because there's got like guys dancing behind her or something. Like there's clips in the film, but there's like guys dancing. But I think there's just like they could be hoods or something. It's like if they were dressed as the Shadow, like a dancing troupe of Shadow.
Amazing. That'd be amazing.
You know what I would want? I would want a Taylor Dane bat dance video.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. I want a Shadow video that looks like bat dance.
Yeah. So you got some Shadows. You got some Siobhan Khans. Yeah, on the dance floor.
Perfect. Yeah, I said, why not?
Who
yeah,
is
I
mean, that? Taylor Dane.
right. I mean, it was so much the formula for these things. You could just see that they had like a sheet and they were, you know, they were all following the Warner Brothers style. Like, okay, well, it's going to get Madonna for the sound. We got Dick Tracy, exactly. We got Madonna for the soundtrack instead of Prince. Taylor Dane is going to like, you know, like a C-level version of that. And I did want to mention sort of the additional merchandising that was done for this thing. There was a toy line. I had one of the Shadow action figures.
Which one?
I had Quick Draw Shadow, where he had two guns, and then you squeezed his legs like superpowers, and they went rah, and he pulled the guns out.
Oh wow, that is super cool.
And he had a translucent piece in his head, so when you shot light through it, his eyes lit up. Wow. And the red light. So now, the problem with the Shadow toy line is it's like nine Shadows, and you know, one Siobhan Khan and like three Siobhan Khan henchmen. What am I supposed to do with that? And weirdly enough, the packaging, you can go look at, you Google these things, you can see it. The packaging is not at all moody. You would think with something called the Shadow, it would be nothing but blacks and reds, and that would really make it pop on toy shelves, but instead they went with this kind of neon green, yellow, purple color scheme. Wow. Yeah. And you're like,
90s.
Yeah. And it's like, they, you know, of course, this is standard. Shadow has like a battle cycle, because we all remember that scene from the movie. And like, there's one where he has a car, and the car is really cool because it's like a 40s style car. They, as far as I know, they never made the cab, which is the thing he rides around in the most. The thing, you know, and they did, there was no Peter Boyle action figure, unfortunately. So, like, it, you know, and the toy line just went nowhere. It was immediately remaindered. I had that Shadow figure for many years. The other piece of merchandise that I want to mention specifically is the pinball machine. Mm. There was a Shadow pinball machine, which, of course, featured some voice clips by Alec Baldwin and and the reason I remember this thing so well is that back when I used to go out to Ohio occasionally to visit some friends, there was a bar that had it, and we would play it. It was right after the movie, and we would play it, and it was a pretty good game. You had to like match the letters, and it would be, you know, K-H-A-N, and he would con and vengeance is mine. But the weird thing was, I kept going back to Ohio, and like, that pinball machine was in this bar for like 5 years. And like, I, you know, we kept going back, and I remember thinking, God, it's 1999. Has nobody from Bally reclaimed this thing? Like, did they just forget that it was there? Because I can't believe that, you know, that they have that the Shadow merchandise juggernaut was such that the pinball machine was still making money. So, and then you can find clips of the game out there. It's obviously finally remembered, but it's just sort of funny to me that that thing outlasted, like, the Shadow came to theaters, went to VHS, and then eventually probably hit cable while the pinball machine was still being played. People were still pumping quarters into it 5 or 6 years later. So, and that's it, unfortunately. I mean, the film is on Blu-ray. It's on streaming. If you have Amazon Prime, it's there for essentially free. So, I mean, it seems doubtful that they'll probably ever do it again. I think Sam Raimi has the rights to it now. I thought I read that, and he wants to make a Shadow movie, but, you know, he's busy with Doctor Strange. So
he wanted to make this one, the 94.
Right, he wanted to make this one, yeah. So who knows if that's ever really going to happen. But, yeah, you know, when I rewatched it, it was like, this is fun. It's not – I think it's three-fourths a great movie. It doesn't quite get there, but it is – it's better than I remembered it. It's certainly better, I have to say, than, like, The Phantom. I don't know. I don't know. It's I haven't seen The Phantom in a long time. Maybe The Phantom is better than I remember it, too.
I think it is.
Oh, is it real? Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's better than you remember it to be, whatever that means.
I'll give it a try.
That bar is. I mean, it's sillier.
Right.
You know, it's a little campier than, but it's, you know, you love the Doc Savage movie.
That's true. I did love the Doc Savage, and that's a very silly movie. That is an incredibly silly movie. So, yeah, it's a fun movie. They did their best. It would have been interesting if they could have done a second one to see where they would have gone with it and maybe fix some of the mistakes or prune some of the things. But, I mean, it's overall a fun movie, and it was kind of fun to revisit. And the Shadow is one of those characters that's just sort of always around. He's always going to be owned by somebody. I mean, what did you say, Cisco? Is Dynamite Entertainment has the rights to him now?
Well, they did. I don't think anymore, but or I don't know. But they had like this extensive line of pulp heroes, and they crossed them over, and you had all these guys in there. So I don't know where who has the license, because obviously the rights must still belong to whoever, you know,
Yeah.
Because I think that went from DC to Dark Horse to Dynamite, right?
I think so. Maybe, yeah, I don't think there's an interim there.
Yeah, because I know Dark Horse did the movie adaptation, the TV adaptation.
They had it during this time, and they were coming out with black and white stories, you know, miniseries, and I have a few of those from that time. So, So who knows? Well, I'm sure we'll see the Shadow again. It's like this eternal kind of character. It's so primal in our hero fiction that it must return.
Absolutely. So, yeah. So if you haven't seen it, go check it out. It's a fun movie. It's probably better than its reputation suggests. And again, maybe we'll be due for revisiting The Phantom. When's his anniversary coming up? Maybe we have to do we did a Zorro month. We didn't quite do a Shadow month. But maybe we'll have to do a Phantom month or something. Go back and revisit that movie. So,
and just real quick, I saw it on HBO Max. So it is on HBO Max also.
Oh, is it really? Okay, mm-hmm. Wow. That's in a couple different places then. Yeah, I love it when I can look something up and it's already on a streaming platform that I pay for. I feel like it's free. It's not free because I'm paying for all of these things, but it feels free. So that was really enjoyable. So, well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me on this special Sunday edition of the Film and Water podcast to talk about The Shadow. It was a lot of fun, and I really did enjoy revisiting this movie.
Yeah, well, me too. And, you know, to what you guys would say, I hope someone makes a Shadow movie again. I'm ready now. I'm primed.
Yeah, let's do it. So, all right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of this show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the Film and Water Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music. We're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. If you like this show and you like me hear you talking about other movies, I have 3 other shows on the network related to movies. My God, that's absurd. I have Fade Out, the upcoming Citizen Kane Minute, and of course, Superman Movie Minute. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, you can go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks, Corey Musa, Gord Tolton, and David H. Gutierrez for their support of the network. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will see you later. Until then, that's a wrap.
I traveled to this country in Genghis Khan's holy crypt to absorb his power in 3 days.
The entire world would hear my roar.
And willingly fall subject to the lost empire of Shan Kane. That is a lovely tie, by the way. May I ask where you acquire it?
Brooks Brothers.
Is that Midtown?
45th and Madison.